I live in Israel. This season is dedicated to the memory of the 1,400 of my countrymen who were massacred on October 7th and the 240 people that were kidnapped and are being held hostage by the terrorist organization Hamas. Hopefully they will be returned to their families as soon as possible, and hopefully this terrible war will be able to come to a peaceful end very soon. Hello, everyone, and welcome to Minute 121 of Season 6 of Movie Rob Minute, the daily podcast where we take a Capra-esque journey through the 1946 classic, It's a Wonderful Life, one minute at a time. I'm Rob, and joining me today is Amanda from Hollywood Consumer. Welcome to the show, Amanda.
Thanks for having me. Excited to be here.
Yeah, I'm really excited to hear your story about this movie. Yeah. we'll get there. We'll get there. And I'm also amazed we finally hit we passed the 2 hour mark of this movie. You know, just another 11 minutes to go, and the movie's all done.
Awesome.
So minute 121 begins with George spying on Mary, and ends with Bert showing up to save the day. So we ended things yesterday with. You know, Clarence eventually telling George where he can find Mary. We talked a little bit about this before, but, you know, it's going to keep coming up. The idea that, you know, that you have a 33-year-old single woman and is considered an old maid. It's a little antiquated. I would think even for 1946, it's pretty antiquated.
Yeah, it hit a little close to home for me in particular.
Yeah, that's not why I give you these episodes.
I was like, wait.
Don't think that way. No. Sorry.
No, it's okay.
it's just very strange. I mean, and you know, the way we see this minute begins with, we see George like spying on Mary, looking at her as she's like leaving the library. And you see how she's dressed. She's not dressed like a let's see, one second. If this is 1945 and she was born, let's say 1910, 1909. So, okay. So maybe she's 35, 36, approximately. You know, we don't know exactly what year she was born, but let's assume that. Because in 1928, she was already, we assume she was still in high, she was graduating high school. So maybe she was born in 1910. So, okay. So she's 35 at this point, or 35, 36, something like that. Just the way that she's dressed is not like a 35-year-old would be dressing in any era. You know, maybe like in Shakespearean era where, you know, no one lived past the age of 20 or something like that. But, you know, because like, do you see like, the way she's dressed, in like a prim and proper way, I guess. Yeah. You can say. She's got her shirt buttoned up all the way to the top. For some reason, in this multiverse, she needs to have glasses. You know, because she didn't have glasses before. I guess not knowing George made her, I don't know, read more so that her eyes got. She had trouble with her eyesight. I don't know. It's you know, this is another one of those things where. We're not really sure how George not being in the universe, caused certain things. You know, this is one of them. I can understand that George not being in the universe causing her to remain single. Okay, that I can understand because, you know, from the perspective that these are soulmates and when, you know, her soulmate isn't around, so therefore she's alone. Okay, I can understand from that perspective. But, you know, the way that she's dressed here and the fact that she's got eyeglasses and also you see the way that she's holding her purse. You know, it's a very defensive way. I mean, I guess Potterville is a scary place.
Yeah, I was going to say maybe that's the case. She's kind of bundled up and holding the purse close because she's in Pottersville. And she's just worried about walking down the street with her.
That's right. You gotta watch out for Biff Tannen and all his men and stuff like that, you know. Even though, again, I've mentioned this before, we never see Potter here. We know he's alive, but we don't know where we don't see him, because we had Violet, was it 2 weeks ago, mention the fact that, or maybe it was last week, mention the fact that she knows Potter, and she knows people in high places. So, okay, so Potter's still around, but we never get to see him, which I think is too bad. I think it would have been really fun to see the Potter of this universe, just like in Back to the Future 2, where you see the Biff Tannen of 1985, the alternate 1985. So you see what he became after, creating this. I don't know if you want to call it a kingdom, or would do you can you think of a better word for than kingdom for what it is?
Oh, his domain.
I
I
would
don't
is.
know.
Okay,
Yeah.
maybe domain. There's another word that I'm thinking of that I just can't think of. I just it doesn't. It's on the tip of my
Yeah.
tongue right now. With when I can't think of what it is. I'm sure there's someone right now screaming at their podcast, probably Jay or your father, going, "No,
Yeah.
it's this, it's this." But
Yeah.
yeah,
Yeah, no,
I
but
don't
it
know.
would be interesting to have seen Potter in this version. I wonder, I think it would have been interesting to see him and see that he was not any different, than he was with George around, because Potter is just Potter.
No, but he would be different because now
Yeah,
he's in control of
I think he
everything.
still would have been a bitter old man. Yeah.
Oh, for sure. I wouldn't think that he would be, actually, you know what? Maybe empire
And
or dynasty is the word we're
yeah.
thinking of. Empire. And there you go. You can then compare him to the emperor. There you go. It's, he's created the first, Bedford Falls, Galactic
There you
Empire.
go.
Which has been renamed, the Pottersville Galactic
There you go.
Empire, something like
There
that.
you
I
go.
don't know. Yeah, that's the word I was thinking of, with that. So, I mean, I think it would have been nice to see him, but I think also they want to just let us picture it in our minds, as to what is really going on here. Like, who is, why Pottersville has changed so much, I guess, from that perspective.
Yeah.
I mean, because we see that this is definitely a realm of, I don't know if criminal element is the right term, but it's basically the way that New York was in the 60s and 70s, certain parts of Manhattan, the idea that's where, it's like the slums, and we saw over the last few days, all the different places that have sprung up in Pottersville, all these attractions, for that are not that are
Yeah.
seedy. I guess you could seedy. It's a seedy. Pottersville has become a very seedy town. Let's put it that way.
Yes. It's got a lot of disreputables wandering around.
Yes, correct, correct. And again, it goes back to full circle to what we were saying before, that Mary is probably clutching her purse because of that. It's like, I don't want to stay away from all these irreputable people, and it makes you wonder why they still have a library there.
Yeah, that's a good point.
If it's such an irreputable place, like, who's going to the library?
Yeah, or maybe that's one of the few institutions that they can't tear down because it's, just part of the system there. I don't know. I guess
Yeah,
you
I
have
don't know.
kids still, so kids have to go to school, they have to be able to study and
Well, couldn't they just go on the internet? Come on.
Not in 1945.
No. Well, maybe Potter invented the internet. No, there you go. Potter is really Bill
There you
Gates, so.
go. Modern equivalent.
There you go. So basically, she leaves, and as she's walking, George starts screaming after her, and he goes, "Mary, Mary, 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 Mary." He has to say her name six
Oh,
times before she even turns around. He goes, "It's George. Don't you know me?"
clearly not.
Exactly. And you can see that she gets really scared and starts walking away as briskly as she can. She's like, all right, here's part of this CD element, of
Yeah,
Pottersville.
somebody she doesn't know
A
yelling at
and
her, running up to her in the street. We already know she's clutching a
that's right. And
purse.
he that's right. And he starts following her and she's moving even faster. And he's catching up to her. And he finally catches up to her and grabs her in a strange way that, even if that is his wife, you would think that that's not how he would, normally grab someone.
I think it shows a little bit of the desperation that he's feeling at that point.
Yes. And, he turns her around and says, "Don't you know me? What's happened to us?" And she says, "I don't know you. Let me go." Now, obviously, she has no clue what's going on, but wouldn't you think that people around would have tried to stop something like this?
Maybe, although, if we're thinking about it in the world of Pottersville, maybe people are less likely to jump at something like that because of all those things we've already mentioned, that there's crime.
You mean they don't want to get
Yeah, they don't
involved?
want to get involved. They don't think it's their problem. It's not until she goes into a crowded place where she is surrounded by people that anybody starts to sort of take any sort of initiative. So maybe. Yeah, maybe it's just not in people's natures in this universe to help out somebody who is clearly afraid and vulnerable. Like I said, until it's directly in their faces.
But it also goes to show that none of these people ever visited the library and know that this is a library. Because as we know about Bedford Falls, at least everyone knows, most people know everyone else, except for the one person that doesn't know George, and George doesn't know is the teacher's husband. That's it. Everyone else, everyone else is on a first name basis, or at least a Mr. or Mrs. basis, that type of thing. And I guess George thinks incorrectly, obviously, that their love should be able to transverse the multiverse. That no matter what, he still thinks in his mind that if she sees him, her eyes will just light up and say, "Oh, this is George. This is the person I've been seeking."
Well,
And I find it really interesting that he believes that, because over the last few days he's been bumped into all these people that he apparently knows really well, and none of them know who he is. And he's at a certain, even his mother, and he turns to the point where, okay, the one person who's going to know me is the love of my
Well, and
life.
I think it's because she's the one that he is absolutely sure will have some recognition that's the final point at which he realizes this is not some sort of elaborate joke. This is not some sort of dream, and he has done something terribly, terribly wrong asking for, to never be born. And I think it's that her not knowing him is the thing that finally sends him over the edge and says, "Oh my God, I can't live in a world where Mary doesn't know me." And that's
Right.
the thing that finally makes him turn and decide that he doesn't want what he's asked for.
Right. Correct. Which we'll get to as the next few episodes unfold. What it really comes down to is that as you said, this is his last attempt. If anyone's going to recognize him, he thinks it's going to be her, because of the love. And it's actually very funny. I mean, a little bit of a spoiler: in a few days, when we do It's a Wonderful Wednesday, which won't be on a Wednesday, I actually chose something inadvertently, not even connected to that, which is similar to this idea. So just a little hint for people, if you come back in a few days, you'll be able to hear it. I think we're going to do that on Sunday. So make sure you come back every day until then. But if you happen to skip, so come back for Sunday's episode, where we'll be able to hear that connection, a little bit of a teaser, for everyone out there. And at this point, George starts pleading with her, and he says, "Don't do this to me, please, Mary, help me." And then he starts getting really erratic. He goes, "Where are our kids? I need you, Mary." And she just starts screaming. She's had it. She's she wants someone to help her. Nobody's helping her, but she ends up breaking free, which I guess also shows the fact that as tightly as George is holding her, he's still, you know, doing it in a loving way that she's able to get out of it. You know, he's not doing it in a violent way.
Yeah.
I guess you can say as you said, he's desperate. Yeah. You know, and then as she's running away, at that point, that's when a few people grab him.
Right, right.
You know, there are two men that finally grab George, you know, as he's doing that. And then she runs into some sort of establishment. We don't see the name of the place that she runs into. And as she's running away, George screams to her and says, "Help me, Mary." And he goes, "Mary, let me go," to the two guys, obviously, who are holding on to him. And what's really interesting is I've never heard this before until I looked at the subtitles. But Mary actually says something as she gets into the saloon or whatever you want to call it. Did you happen to catch what she says?
I don't know if it was when she was running in or after she got in or before, but, you know, I think she says something about I don't know him or something, or.
She says, "Help. It's a wild man.
Yes.
The wild man is chasing me. Somebody stop him." So, I mean, it's very interesting that she calls him a wild man.
Well, he is. You know, he is at that point. yeah.
Yes. Right. I mean, thankfully he's not foaming at the mouth yet, you know, but, you know, and what's really funny is in this particular establishment, the first thing that George happens to see are three people that he knows.
Yeah.
You know, he sees three people who had money in the building and loan. So you have Tom, Ed, and Charlie, which are all people who were there, you know, during the bank run, which I just find it really funny that they chose to put these three people, you know, into this establishment. It looks like some sort of possibly a bar or something like that, but you can't really tell. But there are a lot of people that are gathering.
Yeah, I was going to say, this is Christmas Eve, and there are a lot of people out at this establishment on Christmas Eve late in the evening.
Well, it's Pottersville.
And I guess that's the thing.
Why stay home? There's no reason to stay home. Just come and...
come and drink your sorrows away, because, you know, it's Pottersville. You know, that's who knows what sort of home life these people have if they... You know, we get some, I think earlier we get some indications about, is it Ernie, you know, his wife left, and you get some hint at how life is for people who are in Pottersville that are maybe not as close to George, that they're...
So you're basically saying everyone in Pottersville is single.
Either they're all single or they're all very unhappily married.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. And then George points towards Mary and says, "That's my wife." And then Mary basically screams and is about to faint from this whole idea. And then, again, something else that I never paid any attention to, I didn't hear until I looked at the subtitles. So you have three men that say some very strange things. So the first one says, "No, you don't." And then the second one says, "Somebody call the police." And the third guy says, "Someone hit him on the head with a bottle." And then his next comment is, "You need a straitjacket." So I just thought it was very funny, these various comments that don't really make much sense.
Although I guess that kind of, if you think about it, they're reacting to the situation, not sure what to do, except the first thing they want to try to do is get him under control. And how do you do that? Well, if he's obviously he's resisting them pulling, so you got to knock him out and then put him in a straitjacket so that he's not attacking people.
That's right. That's right. Do you know when the straitjacket was invented?
No.
Okay. So first of all, the word straight, STRAIT, means to confine. So it's like a confinement. And there is a book from 1772 by an Irish doctor named David McBride, who mentions in his book. And then in 1790, in France, an upholsterer named Guilleret was the one who actually invented the idea of it. I mean, the obvious idea of it is to be able to, keep someone from being able to flail around or things like that. They used to put like criminals in it also, not just people who were crazy that were in insane asylums and stuff like that. I mean, in America, between 1825 and 1865, so in a period of 40 years, the number of insane asylums increased from 9 to 62. Yeah. So for some reason during that period, a lot of
A
people
lot of
went
people went
crazy.
crazy. Yeah. Well, I have a
Yeah.
quick straitjacket story.
Sure. I'd love to
yeah,
hear that.
not me personally, but I don't know if you know, but my grandfather, my dad's dad, he was a
Yes.
magician, and
That is correct.
my
I know that.
grandmother was his assistant, but she also was what you would call an escape artist, and her trick was escaping from a straitjacket while hanging upside down, suspended from a crane. And
Oh,
there's a
wow.
video somewhere on YouTube of her doing this, and she is, several stories up in the air, hanging upside down, and she gets out of the jacket, and it's really impressive. And I did not inherit that double jointedness that allows for her to be able to do that. But it's pretty impressive. And obviously, I'm sure you know a lot. That
Yeah.
is like a very big magician trick too, getting out of the locked straitjacket.
So in other words, you used to get a little scared going to grandma and grandpa's house because if you didn't act well, they would put you in the straitjacket and say, "Come on, Amanda, try and
No,
get
yeah, I never had
out."
to worry about that. They always plied us with sugar and sweets because they knew we'd go back to our parents and our parents would have to deal with us.
Exactly. Well, so I mean, I'm assuming you probably don't know the record of how long it took your grandmother to get out of the straitjacket. But do you know what the world
I
you
don't
do?
know, I was gonna say.
Oh, okay. Okay. So do you know what the world record is for someone to be able to get out of a straitjacket? Obviously, a magician. The fastest escape from a regulated posey straitjacket. That's the official name of this type of
I
jacket.
don't know, but I would guess it would
Well,
have to be just a few seconds, 'cause I know my grandmother did it pretty quickly.
okay, so the world's record was the world's record was set in August of 2014 by an Italian escape artist named Danilo Odiello, and he was able to get out of the straitjacket in 2.84 seconds.
Wow. Okay, that is impressive.
Yeah, exactly. Very impressive. So you'll have to go back and ask your father if he remembers how quickly grandma was able to get out of a straitjacket.
No, it wasn't 2 point, was it 2.4 seconds? Definitely wasn't that fast.
2.84
2.84 seconds.
seconds.
Yeah, definitely wasn't that fast.
And then it's very funny because we have these comments from these three men, and as the third man gives his comment, so then we hear sirens in the distance. So, that is it. It goes to show that in Pottersville, the cops come very quickly. The response rate is really, really fast.
Little surprising.
Yeah, exactly. Well, it's not
Guess that's
that
true.
big of
Well,
a town, but somehow someone was able to call him, you
and
know.
I think they were already kind of looking for him, I think.
That's true. That is true. Yeah, but he's not running around with the side. No, because he's looking for him on the one hand, but on the other hand, Bert was when he was trying to handcuff Clarence, Clarence disappeared. So Bert wasn't sure if there really was a guy there, or if that was a figment of his imagination. I think that's part of it. And then George starts screaming, "Clarence!" And then we have another man inside of this establishment say, "Get out of here!" And then he once again screams, "Clarence!" you know, and he's just trying to get out of there, trying to figure out where, you know, maybe Clarence can sort this thing out, I guess. And then we get a shot of outside of this establishment, and we show Bert show up. And that's actually how this minute ends. Did you have anything else you want to say about this minute?
No, I mean, I guess just, I think you summarized it pretty well. And I agree with some of the things that we already talked about, that Mary's condition and her inability to recognize George is sort of his final undoing on this whole thing. And I do think it's kind of nice to get a couple, you mentioned there were a couple of the townspeople who show up. I think it's sort of a nice reminder from before, these people that, well, we mentioned it, Pottersville or Bedford Falls, it's a very small town. Everybody kind of knows everybody. I guess it would make sense that somebody would show up at the bar at the same time. I think
it's, on Christmas Eve.
Yeah. I think it's, like I said, I like that it's Mary that finally gets George sort of realizing, and this whole
out of his stupor.
Yeah, and this whole minute is sort of him coming to that realization. And that's why at the end, when he's yelling Clarence, he knows that Clarence is the one that needs to fix this now.
And what's great is also, I mean, you see the look of terror on George's face as he's trying to get out of there. You know, he's realized that's it. I really need to, you know, I need to find Clarence and get back. This is just too much for me.
Right.
You know. All right. So every Thursday, we have a segment called Jimmy Stewart Thursday, where my guests will give their top five Jimmy Stewart performances. So what have you got for us?
Okay. Yeah, so I've got five films. I'm going to do them kind of in an interesting order. I'm not going to include It's a Wonderful Life, because that's, I think, a thing on its own. And I'm sure, you know, you've had plenty of people talk about how amazing he is in the film. Yeah.
Right, but the question is whether you want the movie to get 5 points or not.
Yeah.
You know, because we, you know, I give up points for depending on where you put all of them, you know, where you place them.
Right. Well, all that considered, maybe I'll adjust my list a little bit as I go.
Okay.
But the way that I kind of ranked mine were Jimmy Stewart from sort of his most idealistic to his most disillusioned, because I think that's sort of a theme within his films, that he starts off sort of young and starry-eyed or enthusiastic, and you do even have that in It's a Wonderful Life. You know, he's hopeful as a kid that he's gonna get to go explore the world, and then the whole point is that he never gets to do that. So starting off with like the most idealistic, most hopeful Jimmy Stewart, I have Mr. Smith Goes to Washington. I think, you know, he's very young. The character is supposed to be naive, and he kind of gets in, like I said, in very like Jimmy Stewart role fashion, he gets torn down and brought down a peg as the movie goes along. And it is a little bit, it's one of the things that's great about the movie and great about his performance, is he goes from being this wide-eyed hopeful to, even at the end, I think after everything that's happened, he's still fighting and he's still hopeful. So that's my number five. Going down to my next one, number four would be The Shop Around the Corner. Kind of get to see Jimmy Stewart in like his rom-com stage. I don't, you know, it's old school rom-com. And even though he plays sort of the wizened store manager, he's still, you know, like I said, pretty hopeful, pretty idealistic, has some good moments where he's hopeful. He's, like I said, he's romantic. He's writing these wonderful letters. So that's my number four. And I'm going to go ahead and adjust my list a little bit now and include as my number three, him and It's a Wonderful Life. Because, like I said, I think that we were talking, he starts out very hopeful that he's going to live this life where he's going to go explore the world. He's going to build things. He's going to have amazing experiences. And then slowly throughout the film, those dreams start to be taken away, and he slowly comes to a realization that he's never going to have the dream that he wants. But by the end, he's still turned around and still fairly hopeful, and optimistic about his life. And so that's my number three. My number two is going to be him and The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance. Feel like again, you can tell the theme of he's a young, hopeful lawyer coming to town. His first experience is getting, the crap beat out of him, and even still, he creates a class to teach the townspeople, and he gets them all excited to take part in the voting process, and he still wants to use the law to get his means across. And it isn't until he's finally confronted with the inevitable that he decides that violence is the way that he's going to have to do this. And even after that, he's, devastated by that. And it isn't until the truth comes out that he is able to move forward. But even still, there's just like, not necessarily bitterness, but like just lack of hope. And, and then I think maybe even right at the end, you get a little bit of hopefulness, but really for the majority of the film, he's fighting that battle to stay positive, to stay hopeful and optimistic. And it just keeps beating him down. And then my number one spot is going to go to his role in Vertigo. I think it's a really interesting role for him because he's not really a good guy. He's a detective, and he has his issue that causes him to have this vertigo experience, and that gets taken advantage of. But he's kind of a little bit of a coward, and by the time he is interacting with Judy as Judy, as opposed to I think she's Marlene before, he gets creepy. He wants to make her over and into this person that he doesn't quite realize that she is until later. And even then, when he does finally realize, he forces her to confront. And like I said, it's a very different kind of role for him, where he's not this sort of aw shucks, good guy. He's very, like I said, almost cowardly, kind of not really. He talks about he doesn't really have any interest in getting better, and going back to being a detective. He's like, I don't quite know what the deal is, but he's got his own sort of fortune to live off of, apparently. And so he just kind of like meanders through, and then this whole situation with the woman, and even then, while he's following her, it's supposed to be the wife of his college friend, and he falls in love with her. And so there's also this whole element on that side. So I guess that's just kind of an interesting role for him to be playing. And like I said, very different than what I had as my number five, which is Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, where he's so young and hopeful. Yeah.
Very cool. So what was your honorable mention that got bumped off the list?
The honorable mention that I bumped off the list was Rear Window. So I had, yeah. And I almost even had a third Hitchcock on here. The Man Who Knew Too Much. But I think Rear Window and The Man Who Knew Too Much are very similar to The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance in terms of the role that he's playing, where he's, kind of investigative and, not necessarily really, you know, naive or sort of optimistic at the beginning, but also not like it doesn't change as much throughout the films.
Right. Okay. Yeah. That is fair. All right, great. Thank you very much for that extended list.
Yes.
So, Amanda, do you want to tell people how they can find Amanda?
Yeah. So I am at hollywoodconsumer.wordpress.com. That's the website. And I'm on Instagram as Hollywood_consumer. Pretty easy. And I think I have a Facebook page, but I honestly don't remember the last time I posted to it. So Instagram or the website or how you can get a hold of me.
All right. Very nice. And finding me is very simple. Just do a quick search for Movie Rob Minute. You can find me on Facebook. You can find me on Twitter. And you can find me on my website, movierobminute.com. So until tomorrow, hot dog.
Hot dog.
I love you truly, truly dear. Life with its sorrow, life with its tears.